The Jewish History Soundbites podcast with Yehuda Geber. Immerse yourself in the rich tapestry of Jewish history as we explore fascinating tales and uncover hidden gems from our glorious past. Brought to you by our proud sponsor, Cross River, a leader at the intersection of financial services and technology, committed to empowering the communities they serve. Cross River's steadfast support fuels our mission to preserve our heritage and foster a vibrant future for all. Contact Cross River through their website at crossriver.com.
A date which will live in infamy.
Both of those projects, initiatives, got off the ground because of the Gerer Rebbe.
The 11 Olympic team members slain in West Germany. The Olympic Games.
So gereicht waren die Brüder in Amerika. So tausend Schabbes at the Skizzer.
Out of the 24 who were killed were Americans who had come to learn in Hebron.
I say 1 million Jewish children who were made to be cut in Hussar.
Whoever heard such beautiful words, Hadronavecho Talmud Bavli.
It is never to get with Jewish History Soundbites, and this episode is about the life and times of Reb Yomtiv Lipman Heller, known by his famous sefer, the Tosfos Yontif. Before we get into this today's topic, I have a few very important announcements for the community of listeners of Jewish History Soundbites. Firstly, I will be launching next week a new series. I call it a mini-series. I think it's going to be either 3 or 4 parts. I haven't yet figured out which one, 3 or 4. And it's going to be about the secularization of the Jewish people. It's a topic that I've spoken about in the past on this podcast and have promised to do a series on it. I think it will be very enjoyable, a lot of interesting ideas and new ideas that I've been researching and tossing around in my mind for a while. And a lot of you are very engaged on this topic. So I think it's going to be very, very interesting and everyone's going to enjoy. So that is launching next week, the secularization of the Jewish people. If you think other friends and family of yours will enjoy this series or anything else on Jewish History Soundbites, then please tell them about it. Make sure to be tuned in for next week's launching of this new series. And if you want to help the podcast in general, you can tell other people about it and also drop a rating and even a review on your favorite podcast platform. That is the first announcement. The second announcement is, again, about my upcoming public trip. I've gotten lots of emails from you this past week asking me questions about it. Keep on sending those emails. We'd love to have you. It is a Europe Heritage Tour. We're going to be going to Poland and Hungary and Czech and Slovakia and Austria through Lelechet Tours. That's the company who's managing it. I will be leading the tour. And it will be a fascinating and really, really life-changing journey. The dates are March 18th through March 27th. It sounds a bit long. You're more than welcome to come for all of it. If that's too long for you, then there are options of coming for part of the itinerary, for part of the days, so you don't have to be there for the whole thing and you won't miss out. So if you have any questions about it or you'd like to join, you can email me, Yehuda@YehudaGeber.com, or you can email the company directly to sign up. That is select, S-E-L-E-C-T, at lalechet.com. Lalechet is A-L-A-L-E-C-H-E-T.com, select at lalechet.com. And looking forward to seeing and meeting and joining you on the journey with many Jewish History Soundbites listeners. So now, getting to today's topic is actually someplace that we will be going to on our public trip, upcoming public trip in March. And we go on many, maybe most of our trips. We stop in Krakow by the Kever, the grave of the Tosfos Yontif, Reb Yomtiv Lipman Heller, who in his last years of his life, last 11 or so years of his life, he was the chief rabbi of Krakow, one of the largest and most prominent Jewish communities in the world in the mid-1600s when he was there. And it's a fascinating He had a fascinating life, amazingly, very in many ways tragic, but also, you know, ups and downs. He had some amazing parts of his life as well. And there's never enough time to speak about him in that cemetery because it's a small cemetery and there's a lot of big tzaddikim buried there. The proportion of tzaddikim per cubic meter or whatever it is, the term is, the Ramah is buried there, the Megal HaMukos, the Bach, and several other huge prominent tzaddikim, Taisi Center as well, and we're trying to get in the whole Krakow usually that day, sometimes even a visit to Auschwitz that same day. So we never have enough time to speak about the Taisi Center, so I want to elaborate on his story here in the context of this podcast. His famous sefer on the entire Mishnayos is called Taisi Center, and that's how history names him. His name was actually Reb Gershon Shaul Yomtev Lipman Heller. And if you go with his father, then it's Ben Reb Nassen Halevi Heller. I remember one of the things that's most associated with the Taisis Yantif is that his Misha Beirach that he wrote and composed in his last years following the terrible, terrible massacres of Tach V'Tat, the 1648-1649 Chmelnytsky uprising, which decimated Jewish life in Ukraine and Poland, wiped out hundreds of Jewish communities, tens of thousands of Jews killed, one of the worst pogroms, massacres, tragedies that happened in Jewish history, the Gzeres Tach V'Tat. And he lived through that, and he was the chief rabbi of Krakow then. He, in its aftermath, he was helping rehabilitate, rebuild, helping a lot of igunas, women who didn't know what happened to their husbands, where they were killed, and helping them remarry. He did all kinds of things. And one of the things he did was he wrote this Misha Beirach as a merit that if one does not talk in shul, they merit all the blessings and no terrible things like that should ever happen again. And this Misha Beirach of the Taisis Yantav has become like this clarion call of not talking in shul. And many, many shuls recite it. One of the shuls that I go to says it every week. Some shuls say once a month. And it's a very prominent feature of the memory that the Jewish people has of the Taisis Yantav is this Misha Beirach. So I remember quite some time ago, about 10 years ago or so, I brought a group that the whole entire goal of the group was to be by the Taisis Yantav's kever for his yard site, which if I recall correctly is Vav Elul, the sixth day of Elul, fifth or sixth, I think it's the sixth. And this shul from Brooklyn was very at the head of this movement of not talking in shul, and they were very, very, you know, serious about it and trying to promote it as a goal, not only in their shul but in other shuls as well. And it's a very noble and lofty goal. And we were there on the yard site, and they wanted to recite the entire Tehillim at the yard site, so we were there for a few hours by his kever. And not listening to me speak. We're actually reciting Tehillim, which is probably a better thing to do by the cover than to listen to me blabber and say stories. And at the end, the rabbi said we have to do his name, the Taisis Yantav's name, with the letters of the Aleph Beis in Kuf Yud Tes in Tehillim, where you say, it's a custom to recite the name using this method of psukim in the Kuf Yud Tes Perek of Tehillim. I don't think the rabbi knew what he was in for, because the Taisis Yantav's name is Gershon Shaul Yomtev Lipman Ben Nassen Halevi. I don't know if Heller is included, but it took like an hour and a half just to get through, and I was going nuts. We were like ready there after the whole Tehillim, and now he wanted to do the whole Taisis Yantav's name. I said to the rabbi, I hope you're not going to do Zatzal, like, you know, keep the name and that's it. While I was preparing this episode, just the other day, this is pure coincidence, I did not know that this article was in the making, but on the Sfarim blog, which is a blog that I follow, there was a fantastic article by Dan Rabinowitz, really just coincidentally, just published 2 days ago, about the Taisis Yantav. So I quickly read it to see if there was some relevant information. It was great stuff, like usual. And it was mostly a little bit about his life. It was very interesting. Mostly it's about the falsely attributed painting of the Taisis Yontif. It's a very, very famous painting of one of the Talmidim of Rembrandt. I forgot his name, some funny Dutch name. He lived a lot of his life in Vienna. In any event, and there's this painting by him that's falsely associated with the Taisis Yontif. I never believed that it was the Taisis Yontif, even though I didn't have any proof. It's just in general, I found that nearly 100% of paintings of rabbis from like more than 200-300 years ago are falsely attributed to them, and they're not really the paintings of those rabbis. So no surprises here. But the article went really, really long and substantive in proving that this painting is not of the Taisis Yontif, probably not even of a Jew altogether, but for sure not of the Taisis Yontif. So it was disproving that. However, I did find, which is surprising, that there were, in one paragraph, you know, these Sfarim blog articles by these prominent scholars are usually edited and made sure there's no mistakes. And in one little paragraph, there were three mistakes. So I just wanted to point them out because it's relevant to today's discussion about the Taisis Yontif. I guess maybe that paragraph was added in later without editing. It was kind of surprising that I found those three mistakes in the article. Number one, it said that the year of the Taisis Yontif's passing was 1657, and it's actually 1654, which is pretty clear, and it's on his Matseva also, the year of the passing. You know, sometimes the year of birth is in dispute, which by the Taisis Yontif, it seems to be 1579, but it's not 100% clear. Maybe it was 1578, but the date of the year of death of passing is definitely 1654, not 1657, which is somewhat odd because the correct year is noted later in the same article. It is 1654. The second mistake there is also something that I want to discuss in this episode, is that the Taisis Yontif, like he had it, you know, hardships that he confronted, all these challenges that he went through in his life, and then he was in jail. He was sentenced to death. We're going to get to that story soon, but eventually life went back to being good for him, and he requested in his will that his descendants celebrate the day to celebrate and be joyous and make a suda, a whole festive meal. And the day that he got appointed to the rabbinate he ascended to the Krakow rabbinate. He said, "L'hachzir atar l'yoshna," I returned to my former glory to become a great rabbi of a very prestigious and important community, also with a nice salary, that he could be financially stable. So the day that he got appointed to the Krakow rabbinate was Reish Chodesh Adar, and he wanted his descendants to celebrate on the day. And as far as I know, people who are proud descendants of the Taisis Yontif still, till today, follow this mandate of their illustrious ancestor and make a suda on Reish Chodesh Adar. And that's the day that he ascended the rabbinate, Krakow rabbinate, and he writes explicitly that it's the day that he ascended the Krakow rabbinate, and it was the day that he returned the crown to his glory because he was a rabbi of a prestigious community. The article, though, in the Sfarim blog says that he wanted his descendants to celebrate on the day of his release from jail, which is very strange because the Taisis Yontif himself says that I don't want my descendants to celebrate the day of my release from jail because that's not returning to my former glory. That's just getting out of jail. Once he was able to get a rabbinical position again, an important rabbinical position again, to get to become the rabbi of Krakow, then that's returning the crown to its glory, and that's the day he wants them to celebrate. So it's pretty explicit in the writings of the Taisis Yontif himself. And then the third thing that I found odd in that same paragraph in the article was that it cites Rabbi Yehuda Leib Fishman Maimon, that Rabbi Yehuda Leib Fishman Maimon says that the descendants of the Taisis Yontif, instead of celebrating and spending all this money on partying on Reish Chodesh Adar, instead of doing all that, the descendants would be better off publishing the manuscripts of the Taisis Yontif, because although the Taisis Yontif published himself many of his own writings and Sfarim on a wide gamut of topics, but many of his other writings, and he was a prodigious writer and wrote on so many wide on philosophy and on halacha and on mishnayos and on psak and on Kabbalah and on whatnot, an amazing variety of Sfarim. And so much of it is still in manuscripts. So Rabbi Yudalei Fishman Maimon says instead of his descendants spending all this money on these parties on Rosh Chodesh Adar, they should better, a better use of their funding should be to publish the manuscripts of that have never been published at the Tzadis Yontif. So I found that quote of Rabbi Maimon to be very appropriate for the Svarim blog, because the Svarim blog is obsessed with Svarim, but it's very inappropriate for the Tesis Yantif and his descendants, because the Tesis Yantif wrote explicitly in his memoir, in full lucidity and knowing that he had manuscripts which were not yet published, he still specifically requested that his descendants celebrate and party on that day. And he never mentions anything there, any request to publish his manuscript. So the question is, are you asking his descendants to do what you want to do, or are you want his descendants to do what the Tesis Yantif wanted to, them to do? And I would assume that it's the latter rather than the former. So like I said, the Tesis Yantif wrote many, many Sfarim, most famously his commentary on Mishnayos, but he wrote Sfarim, a couple of his famous Sfarim were commentaries on the Rush, on the Piskei HaRush, on the which is printed in the back of Gemara's today, and that's actually what got him in trouble. We'll get to that soon. What's amazing about the Tesis Yantif is that we don't really have to make up so many stories about him like we often do have to do about other rabbis or historical figures that we don't know much about, and there's a lack of sources. By the Tesis Yantif, we have the best source possible. He's one of the rare rabbis in Jewish history. There's a handful. There are a few. He wasn't the only one, but he's one of the only ones, especially at that time period in the 17th century, who wrote an autobiography, who wrote at least a partial autobiography, not an entire autobiography. He's more about his tragedy and return to his glory. An amazing, amazing account, his own words, his own published, he didn't publish it, published later, many years after his passing, but his own writing. He called it Megillas Eva, and Eva, meaning Eva is like a hostility or animosity thing. So that's exactly what that's what the word it literally means. It also is a play on words, Megillas Eicha. It rhymes Megillas Eva, but it's also the acronym for the first four words of Megillas Eicha. Eicha is the Megillah of mourning, of the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash, and this is also the mourning of the Tesis Yantif, the hardships that he went through and the challenges that he went through and experienced, and his he was arrested and trumped up charges and framed for something he didn't do, which he describes. And so Eva is Eicha Yashva Badad Ha'ir. The first four words of Eicha is those four words, Eicha Yashva Badad Ha'ir. And those the first letter of those four words spell out the word Eva, Aleph Yud Beis Hey. So that's why he called it Megillas Eva. And then there he describes in pretty impressive detail. Now, the Hebrew account of this Megillas Eva is available for free on Hebrew books, and I'm assuming it's available many other places online as well. So if you're welcome to read the original in his own Hebrew, in his own writing. There's also been a few English translations. My personal copy is a translation by Avram Yaakov Finkel, published by CIS Publishing in 1991, and it's called A Chronicle of Hardship and Hope. And it's, I think, as far as I didn't check it word for word, obviously, but I think that it's a pretty accurate translation. So if you prefer the English translation, you can get one of those. And it describes his rabbinate in Prague and in Vienna and a couple of other places. And then it talks about when he returned to Prague, and it describes his whole tragic account of during the 30 Years' War. Between 1618 and 1648, Central Europe was engaged in this, started off as a religious war, then it became more of a political war and the balance of power in Europe. And it was a defining war of European history and of the coming centuries. Very important story, and also how it affected the Jewish communities across Central Europe. And it also affected the Tesis Yantif personally. He was the rabbi of Prague at the time. And in order to fund the war, the emperor taxed the Jewish community. in Prague, prominent Jewish community, large and wealthy Jewish community. So they were they had to give allocated a certain tax that they had to provide to the crown in order to fund this war, the 30 Years' War. This is in 1629 this took place. And the Tosfos Yontif describes how he wanted to do it as a progressive income tax. In other words, the wealthy take a larger burden, not like some sort of head tax, but more of a progressive income tax, that the wealthy take a larger part of the burden than the poor, which makes sense economically and also morally. And that's why the Tosfos Yontif did it. But they guess who didn't like that tax? The wealthy. Now, the wealthy were also the powerful people in the community who are in charge of the employment of the rabbi. And a couple of wealthy individuals, specifically one, but there probably were others involved as well. It seems that it was a few of them. They were so angry at the rabbi for trying to coerce them into paying this heavy tax that they decided to rat him out and frame him. And something he didn't do, and saying that the Sfarim that he published, which were the Lechem Chamudos, the Madanei Melech, the commentaries that the Tosfos Yontif had published, which were commentaries on the Piskei Harush, the halacha that of the psak of the Rush, so they were blasphemous against the Christian faith. Not only that, but these individuals, who obviously were not such kosher individuals, but they were upstanding members of the Jewish community and wealthy members of the Jewish community in Prague, they also convinced or paid off dayanim, rabbis in the community, dayanim on the Besdin, to testify that they, as Jewish experts in Jewish law, had studied the Sfarim of the Tosfos Yontif, and they can attest that it is blasphemous against the Christian faith. So these balabatim, these wealthy individuals, together with these dayanim on the Besdin, they go ahead to the church and to the government, and they tell them that this rabbi, the Tosfos Yontif, Rabbi Yomtiv Lipman Heller, he wrote this blasphemy against the church in his farm, and he's duly arrested. He comes to Vienna to get arrested, and he describes it in detail, how they found him in Prague, and how he decided to go on his own to Vienna to stand for his arrest, that they shouldn't drag him in chains to Vienna. And he stands on trial and he defends himself. He describes how he defends himself in the trial, that it's not true. It's all made up, these charges. He never would write against the Christian faith. And he's writing about the pagans of the ancient world, not about Christianity, which was a very, very common debate and defense of many, many Sfarim written during medieval times and down to the modern era, down to the 19th century and in Tsarist Russia and other places, and he defends himself, and he talks about the Jewish community in Vienna, how they helped him. There are leaders of the Jewish community in Vienna who helped him, and they use their connections with the government and the leaders in the government, and they helped him be transferred to a better prison cell, and he was able to receive visitors and food a whole really detailed description of his trial and his time in jail. He was initially sentenced to death because of this, a terrible thing, and the Jewish community of either Vienna or Prague or both, I don't remember which, were going to be expelled because of this. So in other words, they were going to take it out on the whole Jewish community that they supported their rabbi, so they're all going to be expelled, and they're going to have to pay fines, and he was going to be killed. Really a terrible calamity. So he describes also how he had been sitting on top of the world. He had the best salary of any rabbi in the entire world. The Jewish wealthy Jewish communities of Vienna and of Prague, and he was wealthy, and he published Sfarim, and he had a yeshiva in Prague, and he was respected, and people listened to him, and he had an influence, and he really goes on to describe. And then in one second, everything turned over, and he's arrested, and these fake trumped up charges and crimes he never committed, and he's sentenced to death, and the Jewish community is going to suffer as well. And then through a whole series because of his defense and because of the Jewish community backing him up in Vienna these Shtadlanim, these community leaders and all kinds of connections and everything, and a whole series of events, miraculously, the sentence is commuted. His death sentence is, he does not have a death sentence. He doesn't have a prison sentence. He's able to be sent home, and the Jewish community is not going to be expelled either. But ultimately what happens is that they have to pay a very hefty fine. He 10,000 coins or 12,000. I saw different numbers and different sources. Seems to be it was 10,000 tailors. I don't even know how to pronounce the coins of the Habsburg Empire in the 17th century. And he has to raise the money, which was not easy. He sold all his belongings and savings, and his community members helped out, and they went on his fundraising, and he's reduced to poverty. Not only that, but he was banned from the rabbinate. He was not allowed to serve not only in the rabbinate in Prague, but anywhere in the Habsburg Empire, anywhere in Austria, in Central Europe. That's why he had to go east. He was a rabbi in Ukraine, in Ludmir, and in Nemirov. And then later, he was rabbi in Krakow, in Poland. All that was in Poland, actually, in the Polish kingdom at the time. But he couldn't be a rabbi anywhere in Austria. So he lost his position. He wasn't able to take a new position anywhere in the kingdom. He had to pay this massive fine, but at least he was alive. And then eventually he climbs back up the ladder until eventually he's the rabbi of Krakow. And at the end of this account, he writes that he wants his descendants to fast on the fifth day of Tammuz, Hey Tammuz, because I don't know if the descendants do that part. He says to celebrate on Rosh Chodesh Adar when he became the rabbi of Krakow, to make a party, to make a suda, and to celebrate his return to his glory. And they should fast on the fifth day of Tammuz, the day of his arrest, when he was arrested and sent to Vienna and eventually receive the death sentence, that he was going to have the death sentence to death, which eventually was commuted. But I don't know if they also fast. So the descendants should tell us. If there's any listeners of Jewish History Soundbites who are descendants, please tell us if you make the Suda on Rosh Chodesh Adar and if you fast on the fifth day of Tammuz. In any event, almost all accounts of Megillas Eivas, almost all Megillas Eivas that are published today include a supplement that's supposedly by his son Reb Shmuel, which adds much more sensational details to the story. First of all, like this miraculous event where his son is coming home from yeshiva in Metz, and he's coming home for Bein Hazmanim, and he didn't even know about his father's incarceration, and he's resting in a park, and there's a bull chasing a woman and a child in the park, and he saves them. He gets this bull away, and he saves the lives of this woman and her child. And it turns out that this woman and her child is the wife and child of the French ambassador to Austria in Vienna. The French ambassador has a huge influence by the emperor and his court. And this French ambassador says, "How can I thank you?" So when he finds out about his father's situation, he says, "Oh, can you help me by helping my father out?" And he says, "No problem, consider it done." He goes to the emperor and he takes care of it. The French ambassador takes care of it. And then his son goes on to say, fill in a lot of the details. He names names. He says, "This was the person in Prague who framed my father, and then my father forgave him on his deathbed," which is the great tzidkus of the Taisis Yantif and all that. Now, the problem with this supplement of the son of Shmuel, that it's probably a forgery. In other words, the whole entire thing, not the Megillas Eiva, not the autobiography of the Taisis Yantif, that's all 100% true, that's all from the Taisis Yantif himself. But this supplement by his son only appeared in the mid or late 1800s, and the story seems fishy, this very sensational story, and a bull chasing in a park, and the French ambassador, like taken out of a fairy tale. And the naming names is a little odd. So it's accepted by most scholars that this supplement is a forgery. Of course, that doesn't stop anyone from continuing to publish it. And almost all editions of Megillas Eiva include this supposed supplement of his son, which is very likely a complete forgery and never happened. Speaking of myths and legends associated with the Taisis Yantif, it's incumbent upon me to mention the Yassel of the Holy Miser legend, which also never happened. When we go to the Krakow Cemetery, so the Taisis Yantif is buried on the other side of the cemetery, probably because there was another entrance to the cemetery there, so Rabbanim were always buried near an entrance, so some rabbis were buried near the old entrance, and the Taisis Yantif was buried near the new entrance, so that's why he's probably why he's buried on the other side of the cemetery. But in any event, so someone made up a story eventually, and Shlomo Karlbach is famous for relating it and saying it, a very inspirational story about this miser who Yasala the Holy Miser, who lived in Krakow and never gave any money, and when he died, no poor people had money anymore, and they all came to the Taisis Yantif and said, "What happened? We don't have any money." And they found out that really he had been giving people, even that he was known as a miser and despised as a miser, but really he was supporting everybody, and he did it all secretly because he was such a huge tzaddik. So the Taisis Yantif said, "I want to be buried next to him," and that's why he's buried on the other side of the cemetery, because they had buried this miser on the other side of the cemetery in disgrace because he was, you know, hated by everyone. A whole story like that. Great story, and I'd love to be inspired by it also, and I'm a huge fan of Karl Bach and his stories. Just seems that the story never happens. That's just a minor issue with it. So the Taisis Yantif lives in a very auspicious life and during an auspicious time. This is the 30 Years' War from 1618 to 1648, which decimates Central Europe and affects the Jewish communities of Germany and Bohemia and Moravia, today's Czechoslovakia, which is in Austria, and Austria, the whole Central Europe, and France, of course, also. And like I said, the main narrative of his life is through the 30 Years' War, because in 1629, he's arrested and trumped up charges after this whole taxing issue, and the special taxes were imposed by the government in order to fund the 30 Years' War. So the 30 Years' War plays a major role in his life in many ways also. And then the second event of his, major event of his life, also directly affects him, and that's also in 1648, as soon as the Peace of Westphalia, which ends the 30 Years' War in Central Europe, happens. So peace finally comes to the Jewish communities and to Central Europe in general. The Peace of Westphalia ends the 30 Years' War. The same exact year, 1648, decimates Eastern European Jewish life with the Tach V'Tat, the Khmelnytsky massacres of 1648 and 1649, and that's in Eastern Europe, in Ukraine, Poland, and the Polish Kingdom. And by then, the Taisis Yantif is in Eastern Europe. He had been the rabbi in Lubmir and Nemirov, each for a couple of years, for 3 years each, I think. And then in 1643, he's appointed the rabbi of Krakow, a very prominent, one of the largest and most important, Jewish communities in the world. And he's there for the rest of his life, from 1643 to 1654. And during that time, the Khmelnytsky massacre. So he survives it. Krakow itself was not that hard hit by the Tach V'Tat. But he had to help everyone else. He had to help Igunas. He had to help other Jewish communities rehabilitate and rebuild. And of course, he writes this Miser Beirich as well. So these two major events, the 30 Years' War in Central Europe and then the Khmelnytsky massacres in Eastern Europe, serve as a backdrop to Jewish history. Jewish history doesn't take place in a vacuum. So these major European events have an impact on Jewish life in general in Central Europe and then in Eastern Europe. And of course, it affects the Taisis Yantif's life and his leadership also as well. So I want to fill in a little bit I spoke about most of his life, but now I just want to fill in the blanks because I didn't cover his entire biography. He, at a young age, he grew up in a little town, Wallerstein, I didn't even write it in my notes. I think it's Wallerstein or something like that in Germany. But at a very young age, he goes to Prague. He becomes a student of the Maharal of Prague, who lives in Prague during that time. So he's a student of the Maharal. And at a young age, about 18, he already has smicha. He's a rabbi. He becomes a dayan on the Prague Beis Din. For the next 27, 28 years, he's a dayan and rabbi in Prague. So long time. Then he's not the rabbi of Prague yet. That comes later. He's like a minor rabbi, a dayan on the Beis Din kind of thing at this point in Prague, but for a long, long time. And from a very young age, he's very prominent. He's publishing his svarim already on a wide variety of topics. And then he becomes the rabbi for a short time, a couple of months, in Nikolsburg, today's Mikulov in Czechia, in Czech Republic. So Nikolsburg, which had many, many prominent rabbonim, also had the Taisis Yantif for a few months. And then a few months later, he becomes the rabbi in Vienna. And he's there for a couple of years, about 2 years or so. And this fascinating story, during his short stint in Vienna, which was very successful, so his main accomplishment, which he himself writes in his autobiography, so again, we're relying on him, his own account, so we know that it's 100% true, is that he says that when he came to Vienna, the Jews in Vienna were living all over the city. And if they're living all over the city in many different neighborhoods of the city, so they're living among the non-Jews. and they can have influenced by the non-Jews. Anti-Semitism, they can get in trouble from non-Jews, and also influenced by the non-Jews, by the non-Jewish society. Now, again, this is a pre-modern era. This is not during the modern era. This is before emancipation. This is before any secularization that is going on or anything like that. This is the 1600s. But he felt that it would be better if the Jews lived in their own little community. Now, we know from the medieval times that Jews were forced to live in ghettos. In Venice, the first ghetto, there was the Melachs in Morocco, there was ghettos in Frankfurt and other Western European cities, that the Jews were confined to a certain neighborhood of the city, and that's where they were allowed to reside and nowhere else. Here, a very interesting situation, and we have this in other cities as well, that they were not required, even though they were living in Vienna, the crown city, the capital of the empire, they lived all over the city. And the Taisis Yontif saw this as a danger to physical and spiritual danger to Jewish life. So he lobbied the government that what was later called the Leopoldstadt neighborhood, at that time it wasn't called that yet, in Vienna, that this should be a mandated ghetto. He didn't use the word ghetto, obviously, but a mandated Jewish neighborhood for the Jews of Vienna, that all the Jews should live in their own little neighborhood. He literally lobbied the government to allow this. And the government said, okay, fine, you can do it. We'll a special dispensation will allow the Jews to go and live only exclusively in their own neighborhood, and this will be the Jewish neighborhood. So it's amazing. We usually talk about the ghetto as this imposed externally, that the non-Jewish leadership and government forced the Jews into the ghetto. And then the emancipation in the 19th century is the leaving and breaking down of the literal and metaphorical ghetto walls. Here we have the exact opposite taking place. The Jewish rabbi, the leader, sees that it's better physically and spiritually for his community to be, I don't know if literally enclosed in gates and walls, but figuratively in their own neighborhood, separate from the rest of the community. And he convinces, and he says in his autobiography, this was my great accomplishment during my short stint in Vienna. Amazing thing. And then he returns to Prague, and this time he's appointed as the chief rabbi of Prague. And here he's like going back to Prague, to a place where he's very familiar with, and he'd been there for so many years, now he's the chief rabbi. He continues publishing his Sfarim, wide range of Sfarim, most of it he published himself. He was wealthy, he had a very high salary, he was respected, he had a yeshiva, he had students. And then it all fell apart in 1629 with the arrest and frame-up that I mentioned earlier because of the taxes in the 30 Years' War, and he's taken to Vienna. And his death sentence and the expulsion for the Jewish community was commuted. And there was also the intervention of the Jewish community, which I mentioned, and this blasphemy trial where he was sentenced to death and then commuted to a huge fine. But he was forced that there's no more rabbinate. He's not allowed to return to the rabbinate anywhere in Austria. So after he finished fundraising for the fine, and he said he didn't leave Austria to look for a new rabbinical position in Eastern Europe until he paid off his fine, he was not allowed to leave. He had to pay for the entire thing, which was very, very difficult for him. He's now impoverished. He had lost everything. He moved east out of the Habsburg Empire, became the rabbi in Nemirov, then Ludmir, and then Krakow. He also served in a leadership position on the Vad Arba Ha'aretzos, the Council of the Four Lands, the leadership, the autonomous kind of like government within state within a state almost. I spoke about it a few weeks ago on the episode with the Maharsha. So the Taisis Yontif also serves on the leadership of the Vad Arba Ha'aretzos. In fact, one of the things that he railed against, which I spoke about also with the Maharsha, was against the custom of purchasing the rabbinate. So we see that this was a very prevalent custom at the time, because Taisis Yontif is going fire and brimstone against it also. And we know if the rabbis were going against it, then it obviously must have been common. So this idea of rabbis purchasing the rabbinate was apparently very prevalent, and the Taisis Yontif was quite against it. He passed away in 1654. He also says in his autobiography, very interesting, he said that anyone who's going through trouble, anyone who's going through a challenge in life, should read the Megillas Eva, should read his story. And he says that will be a schus, that will be a merit for them to overcome these challenges. I haven't seen that marketed yet as one of these zgulas. I think it's a great zgula to market. We should capitalize on it. I have to figure out how to monetize this zgula. That reading the Megillas Eva, maybe paying Talmidei Chachamim or historians or podcasters or something like that to read it for you, and then you overcome your challenges. The question is if a translation works or you have to read the original in Hebrew. I don't know. This is something to look into. So that's a little bit about the Taisis Yontif. I want to make a reminder, two reminders. One about the new series launching next week about the secularization of the Jewish people. It's going to be big stuff. This is going to be a really interesting series. A lot of chidushim, a lot of surprises, and I hope we don't ruffle too many feathers, but we're ready for it. And another reminder about my trip that I'm leading in March, and to be in touch about that, we'd love to have you as well. So this is Yehuda Gerber Jewish History Soundbites. You can reach me at yehuda@yehudagerber.com. For questions, comments, sources, tours, trips, sponsorships, and lectures, you can subscribe to Jewish History Soundbites on your favorite podcast platform, and I hope you enjoyed.